oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has two matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 040930, the City of Houston versus Donald Clark from Harris County and the 14th Court of Appeals District, and docket number 041023, NRA Allied Chemical Corporation et al., which is an original proceeding. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in these matters, and the court will take a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is ready to hear argument in 040930, the City of Houston versus Donald Clark.
May it please the court, Mr. David Holman will present argument to the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the court. I, together with my co-counsel, Tim Hagley, represent the petitioner, the City of Houston. There is one issue before you today, and that is whether the city has the right to appeal the hearing examiner's decision under 143.1016J of the local government code.
Where do you read that in the statute, Mr. Holman, that the city has this right?
The statute says, in plain words, this is the way that the court construes things is through the plain words of the statute. The statute says that the district court may hear an appeal from the hearing examiner's award. That's a statute. It's 1016J, and it can be found in tab 6 of our brief. The very language of the statute that says the district court may hear an appeal. Now, it doesn't restrict it at all to either party. It doesn't have exclusions for the City of Houston. This court has said
but
that we're...
Let's say that you do have an appeal.
Yes.
How does your appeal fit within the strictures of subsection J?
There are several cases that have discussed that point. There are three cases that we have mentioned in the brief, a case called Blair versus Reyes, a case called Nucci versus Tibby, and a case called City of Garland versus Burr. And they talk about that standard of review. The standard of review is whether the hearing examiner has abused its authority.
Well, it says was without jurisdiction.
Correct.
And he had jurisdiction.
Correct.
Or exceeded his jurisdiction.
That's
what
we're talking.
Is that what you're relying on?
That's what we're talking about. And they talk about when you talk about exceeding your jurisdiction, those courts all said that that means abusing his authority. And let me go into that in some detail.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is if they make a mistake of law, they've exceeded their authority.
Here's what the case says. And the case that is really illustrative about this is Blair versus Reyes. There's also a case called Lindsay versus Firemen's and Policemen Civil Service Commission. But what they say is the hearing examiner has to follow the same duties as the commission. And the Civil Service Commission has a duty to apply Texas law. And the failure to apply Texas law is an abuse of authority. Now, it's just not every decision that's an abuse of authority. It has to be a clear and prejudicial error of law. That's what the Lindsay court says. And in this case, the error of law is that the hearing examiner found, without any precedent, that the acting fire chief could not suspend a firefighter.
Well, but obviously subsection J was intended to severely limit appeal rights.
No question.
That's not much of a limit if you say any time... Because the hearing examiner is going to be called upon to interpret statutes and law all the time, and that's not much of a limitation if we say, if we're questioning their interpretation, that constitutes exceeding their jurisdiction.
The problem is that the hearing examiner is under certain constitutional directives, and that is that you can't have an impermissible delegation of authority to a hearing examiner if it's unchecked.
Well,
you have to have some kind of meaningful review.
You have an impermissible delegation of authority from the chief to some subordinate, and the statute doesn't provide for a subordinate to make those decisions.
It actually does, Your Honor.
Where is that?
In 143.003, the statute provides that the department head means either the fire chief or that person's equivalent. Okay? It's an either or. It's not only the fire chief. It could be that person's equivalent. The Houston Ordinance 34-55 says that in the absence of the fire chief, then an assistant chief can be appointed to act as a fire chief and have full authority thereof. So that's that person's equivalent. So the acting chief certainly has authority to do a suspension under as a department head, and as a department head under the statute.
Well, where did the 14th Court of Appeals go wrong here?
14th Court of Appeals actually didn't address that point because they held that there was no jurisdiction because the city didn't have a right to appeal. But where the hearing examiner went wrong is he based his reliance on a case called Makra. And the case of Makra, was a case that dealt with a different statute and said that only the chief is the department head. But the thing about Makra that you all have to realize is that that was issued just 15 days after the statute was amended to include this or person equivalent language. And so it didn't have the 143.003 language in the statute to consider. That definition is what controls this case.
Counsel, now, let's go back to Justice Medina's original question. When he asked where in the statute does it provide the municipality with the right to appeal, he pointed to 143.1016J.
And in the very first line.
Well, let me ask my question.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Subsection C there, subsection D in that provision, also 143.057 when it talks about appeals from commission decisions, specifically point to firefighters or police officers who decide to appeal. If the language of J is intended to be broad and cover any party's right to appeal, why would the legislature find it necessary to specifically identify firefighters and police officers? That's, from your point of view, surplusage, then. That's unnecessary language.
No, I don't think it is. And
then how do you reconcile it?
And this is also a problem that the court had below. And here's what the court said. The court said because there's no reference to the municipality's right to appeal, and all the references point to the firefighter, then the municipality shouldn't have a right to appeal. And that's the wrong analysis, and I'll tell you why. First of all, most of the references that you're talking about in the statute talk about the firefighter's right to appeal to a hearing examiner. And they're not talking about the appeal to the district court. Where they are talking about the appeal to the district court, as Justice Tom Gray pointed out in the Waco, the Kelly City Waco versus Kelly case, he pointed out that where they do point to the right of the firefighter to the district court, to appeal to the district court, they're talking about restrictions on that right. So that shows us that where they wanted to restrict their right of appeal, they could do so. And that's what the City of Garland case points out, is that nowhere in J, 1016J, does it ever restrict the right. And this court has said that if there are no exclusions, we not only don't read exclusions into the statute, but we must presume that the legislature didn't intend to exclude anything. So therefore, it's broad enough, and we have to presume that it's broad enough to allow the city to appeal.
This is an administrative process created by the legislature, correct?
Correct.
And when that happens, the legislature has substantial authority under the law to determine the contours of that right, the limitations on that right, the limitations, statutes of limitations on those rights. Is this different from a typical common law remedy where under general jurisdiction there would just as a matter of default be a right to appeal? Why wouldn't the argument that there must be a defined right to appeal in this administrative process for there to be a right of appeal, carry the day?
Yeah, there's no common right to appeal. The common law right to appeal, it has to be a statutory right. There's no constitutional right to appeal. I'm going to say that. There has to be a statutory right to appeal. But what the courts have, what the City of Garland Court points out, is that where the legislature wanted to limit the right of appeal in the statute, it has done so. 143.015A says that only the firefighter can appeal from a decision from the commission. And that makes sense because the commission is kind of hired by the city, and they don't want the city to have two bites of that apple because it's a kind of a city organization. They want to give the firefighter the opportunity to appeal, but not the city in that situation. In this situation, there's a good reason why they did not limit the city's right to appeal. And that is because it's an independent third-party hearing examiner. And the independent third-party hearing examiner, in order to make that a level playing field, then both sides have to have a right to appeal from that. Now, there's under the Code Construction Act, which is 311.021 of the government code, it points out that there's a couple things that the court has to consider in construing these statutes. And one is compliance with the Constitution. If this court were to hold that there was no right to appeal, the city had no right to appeal, then this would not pass constitutional muster.
Let me just clarify. I was a little bit confused. I understand if there is no right to appeal, you've got your unconstitutional delegation argument. What if there were a right to appeal, but your appeal didn't fit within this restriction? Are you still arguing unconstitutional delegation or not?
No, we wouldn't be. Okay. I think the courts, particularly the City of Garland Court and the Blair versus Reyes Court, have addressed that and have said that it doesn't matter if it's a limited appeal. You just have to have a meaningful appeal. And, without meaningful review, then this...
Which is to say, if we were to conclude that the exceeding authority is not the issue here, that you don't get an appeal just for an error in law or an abuse of authority, as you say,
right,
then there would be no constitutional problem with this case.
Correct. I mean, as long as the city has a right to appeal, even though it's a limited right to appeal, then it passes constitutional muster. The thing that the court below held was that there's no right to appeal. There's no meaningful review. The hearing examiner can go off unchecked and commit whatever arbitrary abuses of power he can do, and without any kind of governmental judicial review. And that simply doesn't pass constitutional muster.
Counsel, is it your position that subsection J gives both parties the same right to appeal, and that is only on the jurisdiction fraud and those matters set out in that subsection J?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what we believe the plain board is saying.
If that's correct, what is the purpose of putting in the second sentence of subsection C that says if the firefighter or police officer appeals to a hearing examiner? Because isn't that surplusage then? If both parties are bound by the limited appeal of J, why do we even have that sentence in there about the firefighter police officer?
As you read through the statute, the structure of the statute, Your Honor, there are a lot of provisions in there that show what the firefighter is giving up when he elects to go to the hearing exam. He waives his right to go to the district court, and he waives his right to appeal, except for those provisions in the statute. But there's nothing in the statute that says that the city doesn't also have the right to appeal. I mean, I think what the legislature is doing is they're laying out for the firefighter what his options are if he elects to go to the hearing exam.
But if we read that without that second sentence, it says the hearing examiner's decision is final and binding on all parties. If we stop right there, and then we go to J, and both parties get the same right to appeal on jurisdictional matters, those matters set out in J.
Yes, Ryan, and that is because on the plain language of the statute, the legislature didn't restrict the right.
I understand, but if we read it that way and we delete that sentence about the firefighter or police officer, we don't change the statute, so that is surplusage under your interpretation. That sentence is surplusage under your interpretation. Is that correct?
I think it can be read consistently, so I don't think it's good surplusage. I think that the court
but
has.
But does it add anything?
I think it may just emphasize what the firefighter is giving up and that he's getting a limited right to appeal.
So it's redundant.
Every word of the statute has to be considered to have meaning.
Well, you just said it emphasizes what Jay says.
But it certainly, Your Honor, from our perspective, does not limit the right to appeal. It just emphasizes that the firefighter has a limited right to appeal.
A moment ago, you were about to talk about the unconstitutionality of the statute if it's interpreted the way the court has appeal does. Can you address that?
Yes. And the starting point for that analysis is the Proctor versus Andrews case and also the Bull Weevil case that this court said. And there's an eight-factor analysis to determine whether delegation of legislative authority to a private entity is constitutional or not. And the first factor of that analysis is whether there's meaningful review by the governmental agency or the state or a state agency. And that's where this holding below runs into trouble, because they held that their city had no right to appeal. And if so, then this hearing examiner is left unchecked. Now, that's not, under the Code Construction Act, that's neither a compliance with the Constitution, nor is it a just and reasonable result, nor does it favor the public interest over the private interest, all of which has to be done if we're considering how to properly interpret the statute to comply with legislative intent. Under the Code Construction Act, we must presume that it's constitutional, that the legislature intended it to be constitutional, and therefore that there would be a right to appeal, right to meaningful review. Now, there's not the same problem when you have a delegation to the Civil Service Commission, because that's a governmental entity. But when you delegate to a private entity, like the AAA or the Federal Mediation Organization, then you run into trouble with the Constitution, with infringing on the Constitution. In the plain word analysis, I want to point out that City of Garland has already gone through this analysis and has pointed out that when the legislature wanted to limit the right to appeal, it certainly has done so.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May I please the court? Mr. Richard Mooney will present argument from the respondent.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the court. I think that it is true that there's one question before the court today, and that is a statutory interpretation about whether 143.1016 and specifically J grants the explicit or implicit grant of the right to appeal a hearing examiner's ruling to district court.
Is there any distinction between the facts of your case and the Nietzsche case and the Byrd case, Garland, that have been cited in the briefs?
Well, the Nucci case was a hearing examiner appeal, a death action, and a claim for statutory appeal based on a recommended demotion. Ours is a temporary suspension of 15 days. Not a lot of difference there. The court in Nucci found that they reached that there was a jurisdictional question under the DEC Act, and that they found that, and they specifically did not reach the question that's before the court today about whether there's a statutory appeal under subsection J.
But why wouldn't that same analysis apply here? Because there's been a DEC Act action filed, right? And a declaration here would resolve the issue just as it would have in Nucci.
Well, here's what I think the question is today, is that clearly, there's no statutory appeal under J. The real question, probably, that's more troublesome and a hard question for the court, is whether there's some means that the city can bring a declaratory judgment to find out if the hearing examiner did some of those things, either didn't have jurisdiction or exceeded their jurisdiction somehow. And in the Nucci case, they did reach that. They found that there was proper jurisdiction for a declaratory judgment. Since that time, though, the courts have been very stingy with the fact that the Declaratory Judgment Act doesn't grant specific jurisdiction on its own. There has to be some other underlying basis for jurisdiction. In a case where a hearing examiner goes rogue and where the city would have some worry about this delegation to a private authority, they would, we believe, they would have to rely on a constitutional basis or a vested property right for an underlying basis for jurisdiction to bring a declaratory judgment action. Under those things, I think they could properly bring a declaratory judgment. They didn't in this case. They threw it on top of their statutory appeal, saying we're exercising the court's jurisdiction under subsection J, and we want a declaration from the court that this hearing examiner exceeded its jurisdiction one of the restrictions by misinterpreting 143 as it related to the department head.
So there's nothing in 143 that says city can't appeal.
There's no specific exclusionary words.
We're implying into the statute that one party can appeal and the other can't.
Well, I think in construing the statute, if you look at the statute as an entirety, as I think the rules
require. If it doesn't state it, then we're implying.
Yes.
It's either explicit or implied.
That's right.
So we're implying into it that one side has an appeal and one side not. Why should we do that?
Because if you look for the specific reference to J, you look back to subsection C, where the firefighter is waiving their right to come to district court as a matter of course, as it does under the commission, and he's saying these are the restrictions that you have to do if you're going to be able to appeal to the district court from hearing examiner, and they limit it with those.
Why does that mean? I mean, the only person that does an intentional act in referring to an independent examiner is the firefighter. The city takes no intentional act in going to an independent examiner, right?
The city does it. The commission has.
The city's passive. They're just getting drug in, right? So, since waiver is an intentional act, why does it imply anything to say the guy who took the intentional act waives a particular right? And not to say that the city's, I mean, you couldn't deem the city to waive this right by getting sued somewhere. They're not taking an intentional act, are they?
No, I don't think they're taking an intentional act. I think they're.
So why should we imply, because one party acts and the other doesn't, the statute says if you take that act, you waive it. Why does that mean the other party doesn't have the right? Or?
Well, I think because it specifically doesn't grant them an authority. The statute doesn't likewise say the city, you have a right under J. Just like it doesn't say only the firefighter. So it can be read either way. If you look at that subsection in isolation. And I think
if you've got a personal injury claim and I send you a check and say, now if you sign this check and deposit it, you waive your right to sue me. You sign it, deposit it, you waive your right. But if I have a claim against you, I didn't waive anything.
That's true.
Well, why do you imply? I mean, you know, this statute just says if one person does something affirmatively, that's an intentional relinquishment of a known right. Why should we imply that that means the other party has no rights?
I just think that applying the statutory construction rules and reading it in entirety, you come to that conclusion by interpreting what do these words mean. And so, I mean, you can come to the conclusion that by reading the subsection J, that it's a wide open proposition. But I think once you broaden it out, pick up C. And
what do you understand? If we were to find that both could appeal under J, what's the difference in without jurisdiction and exceeded jurisdiction?
Without jurisdiction would be, and you got to really stretch to find one of those, because the whole process is based on a disciplinary matter or some other specific civil service provision that the firefighter is invoking that right to go to hearing examiner. Once they do that, I think the hearing examiner under Lindsay and the other cases is that hearing examiner has the ability to interpret the facts and the statute applied to the case. So he has jurisdiction to decide the issue. Exceeding the jurisdiction is much more common. And that is a case where, and I would grant you that the Nucci case was probably the right outcome, because the statute provides in a demotion case that the hearing examiner can either approve the demotion or reject it. And in that case, he said, I'm going to demote him for a month and then re-promote him. And that was just not one of his choices, and so that's exceeding his jurisdiction. There's probably a myriad of horror stories you could come up with that the hearing examiner says, you know, I don't think they should have fired you. I think they should have promoted you to chief. Well, that would be way beyond his jurisdiction, and I think that the city should have to bring that up under some other basis for challenging. But I don't think that's a question that we have today as to whether that particular section grants them that authority.
Counsel, assuming you're right that the statute, when it specifically says firefighters and police officers may appeal and that's all, assuming that you're right about that, what is the cogent rationale underlying that? Why would the legislature want to only allow one side to appeal. What make sense of that?
Well, I think particularly if you look at the hearing examiner statute as an alternative to what was in place for the first 30 years of this administrative process, and now we've lived under the hearing examiner for 20 years, is that they said, you know, we've been taking these to the commission, it's been a rubber stamp, and it goes to court, and we tie up the courts. Let's provide a administrative process for this independent person to come in, and there'll be some finality, there'll be some efficiency. All of those arguments, I think, go specifically to that first sentence in there where it says the decision of the hearing examiner is final and binding on all parties. And then they carve out, I believe, an exception for the firefighter in case, because he originally had this wide open right of de novo review in the courts, to, well, if the hearing examiner said, in the reverse of exceeding their jurisdiction, they said, I don't think that 9 days suspension was enough for you. You should be fired, which is not one of his choices. The firefighter in that case, if it had been final and binding, period, no more sentences, then the firefighter would be just out of luck because a rogue examiner exceeded their jurisdiction. So I think efficiency of the and finality of that administrative process through binding arbitration has been a alternative that the legislature has kind of laid on top of the Civil Service Act to try and provide a lot less intrusion into the court system that was going on before that.
Where are the hearing examiner's powers defined?
But they're defined based in both 143.057, which is a general, affects all cities that have civil service in Texas, and 1016, which specifically is applicable to Houston because it's a census bracket. Inside of there, in F, I believe, subsection F, in both statutes, subsections, the grant is the same authority that the commission has. And the commission's got these authorities under the disciplinary processes and specifically Houston in 143.117 through 121, in which they say, here's what you can do for a temporary suspension, here's what you can do for how you appeal that indefinite suspension and the appeal of that. And their choices, and like you said, a demotion, they specifically spell out the commission's authority is to do one of two things, approve it or reject it. In a disciplinary matter such as this, they can reject it and overturn the suspension, they can uphold it in full, or they can modify it somewhere in the middle. They can reduce it.
But is there anything that authorizes them to say they can't throw it out based on higher authority? I mean, are they reviewed to reviewing the merits of the disciplinary action as opposed to whether someone had the authority to institute the discipline?
No, I don't think that they're restricted to do that. And I think there's an entire set of cases since this court, by this court in 1959, through Popescu from San Antonio and Steve Williams' case from the 14th Court in 2003, in which they say hearing examiners and the commission both have this authority to not only be the fact finders in these administrative matters, but also they have the authority to administer the statute. They've been granted that by the legislature to apply the law, that Civil Service Act, to the facts of that case and make a determination.
Does the statute give someone else other than the fire chief the authority to promote and demote members of his staff?
To promote or demote?
Right.
No, I don't believe so. It's specific language as it relates to the department head, and as it relates to the question that Mr. Holman fielded earlier, where the city wants to mince words about or the equivalent, that's nomenclature about do they call him the department head, do they call him the superintendent of fire, do they call him the fire chief? There's only one department head under the statute. We believe that that's the case. And the department head is charged with the responsibility under the act of promoting, demoting, disciplining those.
Do you have to consider the circumstances here? I mean, this is sort of an odd event. My understanding was that Chief Tyre was suspended while this investigation happened, and therefore no one could ever demote. What if they had found that he had acted improperly and never reinstated him? Under your argument, no one could ever investigate what happened here and demote someone.
Well, the facts of this case are that Chief Tyra was suspended for 1 week. In that 1 week, he, Chief Tyra, had personally appointed or selected two underlying assistant chiefs to split that week to take his place, to be the fire chief for that week.
To be now, the head of the department.
I'm sorry?
To be the heads of the department for that week.
To act, their specific role was acting fire chief. Well, we believe that a strict construction and interpretation of department head is leaves you with one person. That's Chief Tyra until he's removed, even though he's absent. It's not much different than if he was on vacation that week in Wyoming, that he put somebody in place.
If he's suspended for 3 months pending the investigation, under your argument, no one can ever be disciplined.
Well, in an instance where someone, the department head, was somehow incapacitated or removed, and the mayor did not select a replacement in the interim, that might be the case. But that's not the facts of this case. Chief Tyra was suspended for 1 week, and this was within the first 30 days of the alleged infraction.
So was he head of the department while he was suspended? Is that your position?
He was the department head while he was suspended.
So his suspension didn't do anything?
It left him without a paycheck for a week, I think.
Yeah, but, I mean, you can be suspended with or without pay. And what does suspended mean? That's got to mean you're not. I mean, what does suspended mean in appointing an acting fire chief other than the acting person is the head of the department while you're suspended?
Well,
That's not hard, is it?
No, I think that for the routine matters that get conducted in the business of the department, they pick some assistant chief and that person plays that role. We think that there are heightened specific guidelines from the legislature and the Civil Service Act as to some of the roles that the chief can take as it relates to discipline, promotion, and demotion, because the act sets up that these are supposed to be tenured employees subject to just cause standard. And we think that the department head, there's good rationale, we think, and policy basis by which they say we ought to let one person do that and not, as in Houston, where they have a dozen assistant chiefs that come from whatever background, maybe not any supervisory experience, and they're going to be making decisions about tenured employees.
And I'm sorry, just back to my original question. Let's say he had been suspended for 3 months pending an investigation. How would anyone have the authority under your argument? Would the mayor then have to appoint someone with the council's approval, and then they would have authority as acting chief?
We believe that if the mayor, if for some reason he removes the department head, the fire chief, and the mayor appoints somebody, and that's the fact basis in Nixon, if that is the case, we believe they have the implicit authority to act.
But what if it's only that's for a week?
We don't think that a week. We think that's the same as a vacation.
So the bottom line is, your client, who sent the ambulance to the wrong address, so a police officer is there, seriously injured, and there's no, you know, there's a delay in getting to him, and it's your guy's fault, because of this technicality, we should just forget it all. And I mean, what does this have to do with justice?
Well, I think there's two things there. And one of the other facts in this case is that there's a reason the mayor suspended Chief Tyra, and that is he put a hearing impaired dispatcher answering phones for emergency calls.
So we should punish the chief, but not your client, of course.
And quite frankly, there's very little question in this case. If the department had waited 1 week, in which they had 180 days to act, if they'd have waited 1 week and Chief Tyra showed up the next Monday and handed Mr. Clark his suspension, and the hearing examiner had found on the merits, he would have served his 15-day suspension.
But then you would be in there arguing, I mean, you know, that looks like he's retaliating, doesn't it? Because he got punished for doing this, he's going to hammer your guy for it. I mean, the whole reason you suspend the chief out of this procedure for a week is because he's implicated in it. So what sense does it make to say, well, just wait till the implicated guy comes back and then he can retaliate against your client? I mean, the whole reason you suspended him was to have somebody who wasn't involved discipline your client, wasn't it?
No, I don't believe there's anything in the record that indicates that the mayor suspended Chief Tyra to take him out of the loop so that one of his underlings could suspend Donald Clark. I don't think.
But what you're arguing for would put that argument into play, would it not?
Well, I mean, I guess somebody could make that argument, but quite frankly, my experience in the arbitration of these discipline cases is it's going to stand on its own merits about whether the hearing examiner finds that Donald Clark violated the rules of the department and whether the punishment was fitting of the crime. And if it is, they uphold it. I mean, the fact that Chief Tyra was suspended and that Chief Keneally imposed a suspension, I don't know that that makes any difference in the appeal that Donald Clark went through in his arbitration. He went and argued that he shouldn't have been suspended for 15 days. He could have pointed to Chief Tyra and said, it's not my fault at all. It's Chief Tyra's fault. And that's not what happened. So I don't know that the fact that Chief Tyra's name was on the paper would have made that issue rise to the top of the basis for them to argue. I think in addition that the city wants to try and dredge up the issue about the constitutionality of the delegation hearing examiners would fail under some Boeville analysis if, in fact, you were to find that they don't have a right of appeal statutorily under the Civil Service Act. I don't think that that's a question that's before the court, and I don't think that even if they were to do that, that's the outcome that you necessarily arise to. But I don't think that the court's going to reach that, so I just wanted to point that out. It's clear that the...
Was that issue raised at the Court of Appeals?
No.
Was it in the briefing?
No. No. Matter of fact, the procedural posture of this case is we both were going up there to argue whether the assistant chief was the department head under statutory construction, and the Court of Appeals on their own took up the jurisdictional issue under subsection J and rendered their decision. So I think that if you do a statutory interpretation and construction of this statute under the guidelines that are before the court that are established, you'll come to the conclusion that really only the firefighter has that appeal. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
Mr. Holman, help me with one thing. Assuming there's a right to appeal from the city, putting aside Boeville, the grounds for that appeal are confined by J. There's no jurisdiction, there's excessive jurisdiction, and there's fraud collusion. You're trying to shoehorn yourself into exceeded jurisdiction, is that right?
Correct.
Help me understand specifically why that is.
Okay. The best case to look to, I think, the most recent case to look to, is a case called City of San Antonio versus Longoria. It's one of Justice Green's last opinions. He was on the panel. Justice Marion issued the opinion. But it's a memorandum opinion that goes through that analysis. And it says that the standard of under this statute, this limited statute, the exceeding authority, is when the hearing examiner has abused his authority. He's got to follow the law. He doesn't follow the law. As in here, in the arbitrator's decision here, he says, I'm not bound by the courts. Be that as it may, the court says, citing other cases, that an abuse of authority exists when there is a clear and prejudicial error of law. A clear and prejudicial error of law would be one like this one, where they're completely wrong on the law. They've disregarded 143.003, they've disregarded the city ordinance, and they've disregarded the policy behind having an inactive chief. That's a clear and prejudicial error of law that's exceeding your jurisdiction by acting outside the boundaries of law, and therefore it's
so you're not arguing without jurisdiction. Fraud or collusion. It's just exceeded jurisdiction.
Yeah, the way that
what you define as
abuse of authority.
A mistake. If they got it wrong, that's an accession, or they exceeded their jurisdiction.
If it was something wrong on a technical matter, a non-material matter, but here it's a dispositive matter. They got it wrong on an issue that's clearly prejudicial. And under
the problem with that test, though, is you're going to get review in every single case because
that's what everybody says that loses arbitration.
The law was right or wrong, and if we hold, well, the law was right, he applied the law correctly, then there is no right to appeal because he didn't accept his jurisdiction.
There are cases where the Lindsay case, for example, that talks about if you're just talking about whether his opinion is correct or not, then that's not an exceeding the jurisdiction situation. I don't think we're talking about whether he's correct or not. We're talking about a situation where he has committed a prejudicial error of law that's dispositive on this issue that was completely an abuse of his authority because he didn't follow any Texas law or Texas precedent.
But you're not going to be up here on any issue of law that's not dispositive. I mean, it's a bit circular, I think. I mean, the limitation would then be very little limitation at all in J.
Yeah. I think that it all boils down to where I think it's 143.1016C, where it's or 16F, where it says that the hearing examiner has the duties and powers of the commission. The duties being he has to follow the law. So if he doesn't follow the law, if he acts arbitrarily and unreasonably, then the court can step in. That's what's meant by meaningful judicial review. And I don't think that there's any inconsistency there. I think if it's a minor matter, if it's something that you're just claiming that there's been some technicality, I don't think that's exceeding his jurisdiction. But if you're talking about something or something in which he has discretion, I don't think that that would be an abuse of authority. But there's certainly an abuse of authority when he acts outside the boundaries of the law, which is outside of his exceeding his jurisdiction to do that. One other point I'd like to make. My opponent said that they could find by reading J that both sides could appeal. I'd like to point out that J is the only section in the statute that talks about the right to appeal. It gives the right to appeal. So if you can find that, then I think you need to pull the papers.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will now take a brief recess.